Major General Download, Reel 6. Apart from the Turks and the Americans, did you see any other Allied forces?
Yes, we did. We used to see there was an Indian field ambulance in support of the Commonwealth Division. Very effective, very good. There was also, I think there were Swedes, there was a Swedish field ambulance. Were mainly the ones who were around us of foreign armies seemed to be in support roles, either as field ambulances or transport or some form of logistic unit. We also occasionally used to see the Thailands. There was a Siamese battalion, I seem to remember, who would come down through our positions occasionally, or through the Commonwealth Division. So on the whole, that most of the sort of the other Allied troops that we saw were only probably passing through our area, or we saw them when we got back about as far as Seoul or somewhere like that. But rarely did we actually see them in operation with us, apart from the Indians, who, of course, were very much aligned to the British system and, of course, were very much in close support to us. And we did actually have Indian officers on the staff there. There were two Indian officers on the headquarters staff at the Commonwealth Division.
Who provided your medical cover?
For the flight, we came under the normal arrangements with the field ambulance back behind the Commonwealth Division, or behind the headquarters. And then, of course, one was evacuated. If one had to be evacuated, one was then sort of taken back direct down to Seoul, and then from there was evacuated from Seoul, from Kimpo, direct to Kure, where there was a proper hospital, where some proper surgery could be carried out. If it was a case of field surgery, urgent surgery, one was more likely to find oneself picked up by a helicopter, which happened with quite a lot of our troops in the divisional area, picked up by helicopter and taken over to the MASH, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, which was American run, over more towards the sort of the direct line of communication, the core main supply route, and they were operated on there, probably given some immediate attention there, and then sort of evacuated back, eventually back down to Seoul, and then ultimately back to Japan. But the first line of attention usually was at the MASH if it was urgent. If it was a fairly routine thing, then we would be taken back to one of our own field ambulances if there was time to do it, and then back into the system.
What was the general state of health in the flight?
It was pretty good the whole time. There was occasionally one would have sort of the odd, in the winter months, the odd sort of cold or something like that, or flu, but otherwise, in other words, there was very little difference to the state of health to that which we found in England. But what one had to watch was that personal hygiene could have given rise to sort of a certain amount of ill health, or even bad diet if chaps didn't take care of themselves, look after themselves properly. And of course, one was, every so often, one was inoculated against typhus or typhoid and the various other sort of types of diseases one would find in the Far East. But there was one particularly unpleasant one, which was really sort of, it was a form of the same sort of disease as bubonic plague, which was carried by rats. And they found this, that one or two chaps, I think in the division, but certainly one or two in the other armies, had been affected by this, and it was usually fatal. But it was carried by a form of flea, carried by rats in the first place, and if one was bitten by this, the thing is that it could cause very serious illness, as I say, quite often fatal. But fortunately, so far as my flight was concerned, this didn't happen, and I think that a lot of this, of course, had to do with sort of personal hygiene, making sure that, first of all, that people sort of observed the sort of the simple rules of hygiene in the forward areas, and that was that you didn't leave food lying around to attract rats. Secondly, that soldiers changed their clothes frequently and washed frequently, which mine were able to do, being fairly near to the local bath unit. And thirdly, that people sort of were aware of it, without being alarmist about it, but anyway, that people were aware of this particular sort of plague and kept an eye open for it and reported it if they should see it.
You were mentioning earlier on that one of the important things was to keep warm in leisure time. What was there to do to occupy yourselves, to occupy the troops, to occupy you when You weren't actually working and you were in the forward area.
There was quite a good there was quite good support by ENSA, or the equivalent of ENSA, whatever it was called at that time. I think it was Combined Services Entertainment, which came from all sort of the Commonwealth countries. Predominantly English stars came out, but quite often you get Australians, sometimes New Zealanders, and sometimes Canadians, and occasionally we get one or two of the Americans would come across as well. But there were some good live shows. I remember on one occasion, although she wasn't part of the entertainment for the Commonwealth division, but I remember meeting Marilyn Monroe, who landed at my strip, and she was actually out sort of to entertain the American troops. But she landed at the strip and was then going on to the United States Marine Division over on our left. In addition to live shows, cinemas, of course, we had sort of certainly back away from sort of the forward areas. I think Brigade, probably at the Brigade level, there were cinema shows put on with sort of up-to-date films, all in black and white, of course, at that time. These were very popular. Occasionally you would have sort of sing songs, concerts and so forth, if one could find somebody to organize them. But after a time, we eventually developed, it was probably just about the time we went there, we developed a local leave center, which was only applicable to the Commonwealth Division down at Incheon, which wasn't too far away from us. It was about, you had to go through Seoul to get to it, and I suppose by road it was about 2.5 hours drive. I could fly down there in half an hour. But that was right on the edge of the sea, very pleasant, and it was a place where soldiers could go and spend a few days down there, clean up. And that was run by two ladies from the WVS who ran that. They'd come out from England, and this was very popular with the British soldiers to go down there and literally have a rest. Plenty of magazines to read, and the WVS used to organise usual things like bingo and card games and that sort of thing. So everything was done to try and sort of give them some sort of relief. The main thing really was not so much when the troops were in the forward area, they were at least kept fairly well on their toes. It's more when they came back at the rear areas where they get completely bored, and then sort of troubles usually would be reflected in sort of chaps getting hold of alcohol and sort of just really sort of going berserk on occasions.
The habitual soldierly pursuits.
Yes, that's right.
You were mentioning leaflets to me, Chinese communist leaflets.
Oh, yes.
Did you have a lot of Chinese and North Korean communist propaganda directed at you?
Yes, it was. There was quite a lot. Sometimes it used to appear back in the rear areas, way behind us. I think this was more directed at the, sort of the civil population, where one can only assume there were agents or people who were sympathetic to the communist cause who would distribute leaflets in the sort of Seoul area. You'd suddenly just find leaflets thrown around in the streets, and how they got there, nobody was too sure. But they were communist leaflets. But the ones which I came across were well coordinated. They'd somebody with sort of an eye to sort of PR had sort of made the leaflets up, photographs, doctored up photographs usually, showing sort of American troops with heavy casualties or American troops carrying out some sort of atrocity or anything at all which had sort of a propaganda value. But they were sometimes even produced in colour, and well produced at that, and then writing after that or printing after that, usually in fairly simple sort of type of the printing, but saying, Allied soldiers or sort of soldiers of the United Nations forces, why are you fighting this war? You do not understand why you are fighting on Korean soil. Bring this leaflet with you. Come over to our side and you will have a good time. There's plenty of food and women, and so be well looked after. Bring this leaflet with you as your free pass, and we will take care of you. That sort of thing, which took nobody in, of course. But they were fired. These leaflets were fired usually by artillery shells and thrown out over the tops of our own troops along the Commonwealth Division. But similarly, I presume that other language leaflets were prepared and thrown at the Turks and people like that.
Was there ever any propaganda by a loudspeaker?
I didn't hear it myself. There was, yes, I know there was a loudspeaker which used to occasionally be set up in front of the Commonwealth Division up towards, I think, in front of 227 and Little Gibraltar, 355. There was a loudspeaker which used to occasionally be brought forward there, and it was fairly obvious that a short, one or two sort of rather clipped short announcements in broken English would start, and then there would be a record, and then there would be a girl singing, and this girl's voice would then, it was all pre-recorded, it would then say, British soldiers, the similar sort of thing, you know, so come over to our side, we will take care. It was supposed to be enticing sort of noises she was making, which used to sort of bring sort of howls of derision and laughter from the sort of British troops, and usually with a considerable number of obscenities being shouted back.
So this propaganda seems to have acted as a morale raiser rather than...
It was, really, yes. I guess I think our own soldiers took it as something sort of fairly humorous. And, of course, if they could spot the loudspeaker, which I don't think they ever did, but we'd always put a few bursts of fire in that direction, but not that it would have actually have hit any operator, I don't think. Probably if they had have knocked sort of the loudspeaker out, that would have been... that really would have been hitting the bull, I think, straight off.
Did you get heavily involved in the fighting on the Hook in the spring of 1953?
I was actually, at that particular time, I was just handing over. But, yes, some of my pilots, two of the pilots were involved with that. The chap I had handed over the flight to was and had been with me some months. He certainly covered it and was telling me sometime later about sort of the coverage of the Hook battle. I had seen one of the earlier battles on the Hook and one or two of the other earlier battles along the front there, but I think that was probably the Hook 2 or Hook 3 even, that date.
When the Chinese were preparing to make an attack such as that they made on the Hook, were there unmistakable signs that you could spot easily from the air?
There were unmistakable signs if you could see them. That was the greatest difficulty, but I remember one evening... towards one of the winter afternoons, spotting a large number of troops moving forward in these trenches, these long communication trenches. And this was not an unusual movement to see in the afternoon, and certainly not to see so many. And I was able to get the message back that troops were moving up, and they were pretty close to sort of the forward areas, and it was fairly obvious that they were sort of about to mount an attack. And the whole of the Commonwealth Division was put on its guard, and sure enough, an attack did come in, but it didn't come in until the early morning. And what they did, apparently, was that they just literally lay up overnight, moved out of the trenches, lay up overnight, completely camouflaged, and nobody could see them, even with flares going up and things like that. Nobody could see them, but they were there all night, and then attacked at dawn. That, I think, was rather unusual for the Koreans to do that, to attack at dawn. I think that, and the Chinese, they always like to attack last light and to go in and sort of fight a battle in the dark, or just as it was getting dark, and then sort of consolidate in the dark and be well dug in by next morning. That seemed to be their normal tactic.
You'd mentioned their mortars being expertly used. What about their ordinary artillery? Was that good?
Yes, it was sporadic, I think. And I think the guns were fairly old. I don't think they were. I don't think they had much in the way of modern artillery. There was certainly nothing which was comparable to the 25-pounder, either from the point of view of its mobility or its range or its ability to fire sort of accurately and quickly. And the way they used to use most of their guns in the forward area was to have them completely concealed in the sides of the hills and then pull them out and then fire. So it really meant that so the guns had to be positioned and set up probably maybe sort of for a counter-bombardment role or sort of for an assigned target. But, of course, they never really worried too much, certainly not after a few months, they never really worried too much about carrying out a defensive role. They knew the line as well as we did. They knew that the line was pretty well static because the talks were already in progress at Panmunjom. So most of their artillery fire was really harassing fire and perhaps an attempt at counter-bombardment, which I don't think was terribly effective.
You mentioned the first time that you had mortar on your airstrip, the people diving into their slip trenches to get away from it.
Yes.
Did you ever suffer any damage or loss or casualty from...
No. No, we didn't at all. There was no... We didn't have anything which came near enough, really, to cause any damage to us, but there would be no doubt if they had managed to sort of put any shells or mortar bombs down on us on the strip, initially that we would have suffered damage to the aircraft because, as I mentioned earlier, they were completely exposed merely under camouflage nets with no sort of bomb bays or protection bays around them.
How many aircraft did you actually go through in your tour of duty there? How many new ones had to come in to replace old ones or damaged ones?
How often or where? Or
how many, roughly, did you get through?
I think I went out there with six aircraft, one of which was really sort of a training aircraft, which was kept most of the time back at Iwakuni. It was a sort of a dual control. So I had six aircraft, and we wrote off... there were three written off during the time I was there, two due to enemy action and one due to a flying accident.
Do you think you learned any particularly important lessons from your time in Korea?
I suppose looking back over my soldiering experience, I've learned lessons in every theatre. I suppose at that time it was my first occasion of being able to operate and see how a divisional headquarters worked. During the 39-45 war, when I was with a parachute regiment, I was very much at company level, later as intelligence officer, battalion intelligence officer. I saw a bit how battalion worked, battalion headquarters worked, and of course occasionally would come in contact with brigade. This occasion I saw how divisional headquarters worked, and I think that was probably the best part of my education, was understanding the sort of the system of control from the divisional headquarters down to brigade and down to the forward troops. I think from the point of view of the theatre and that particular type of operation, the biggest lesson I learned was really the need for discipline, an understanding type of discipline. It would have been very easy to have tried to maintain an iron hand discipline and say, right, this is the way we're all going to do it, and to be very inflexible. Partly because the Commonwealth Division was a mixture of forces, British regiments, in other words, English, Scots, Welsh, all mixed up together, that was nothing new. But to be working alongside Australians, New Zealanders, Canadians, and with supporting forces, say, from the Indians, one then had to realize that there was a need for sort of an understanding of one's fellow beings within the system, within the Commonwealth system, and also, of course, learning to cooperate with one's allied forces, principally the Americans. So I think the biggest lesson I learned was really on the sort of the form of sort of discipline that had to be applied, an understanding form of discipline, and after all, these were mostly national service soldiers, very unused to this type of war, had very little training for that type of war in Korea. Certainly understanding the man management from the point of view of maintaining morale and maintaining sort of the general well-being of one's soldiers, health-wise, as much as anything. And thirdly, I think from the point of view of understanding sort of the political scene, whereas up till that time, prior to going to Korea, never been myself, not being terribly politically aware of what was going on in the world, I suddenly realized what the communist threat really meant to all countries in general, particularly the United Nations. And that was probably the biggest lesson I learned, was really what the United Nations stood for. It wasn't until I got back to this country and really swatted it all up and found out exactly why it had been brought into existence, what its purpose was, and what the sort of the threat of the communist world was, that it really came home to me. So it was more a case of education rather than lessons learned.
You mentioned the differing Commonwealth forces in the division. Did you perceive the various Commonwealth units, the Australians, New Zealanders and so forth, as having distinct temperamental characteristics?
Yes, very much so. We expected it. Or the Australians. The Australians were very much a law unto themselves. Good fighters, no doubt about it. Very tough, and required tough discipline from their own officers, which they got. There was no doubt about it that the battalions there were well disciplined and very good commanding officers and very good officers right down to platoon level. And they gave a very good account of themselves. The New Zealanders were there as gunners. It was a gunner regiment, a 16 New Zealand regiment, Royal Artillery. Very efficient, equipped with 25-pounders, And I thought probably we're nearer to us, despite the fact that they've come from the other side of the world, we're nearer to our own sort of system and our own understanding than perhaps the Australians were. Canadians really wanted to be left on their own most of the time. As a brigade, they kept their own sort of brigade headquarters, entirely Canadian officer staffed, right down to through all their own system. They even had a certain amount of their own logistics system was manned by Canadians, that they had their own sort of rationing system, they had their own vehicles, so there had to be a sort of separate channel coming up through sort of the British Commonwealth Division for the Canadian Brigade, and they'd rather jealously guarded that independence. They were far more independent than either the Australians or the New Zealanders in relation to the Commonwealth Division.
Was there any discernible difference between the French speakers and the English speakers in the Canadian Brigade?
I think there probably was, although I couldn't put my finger on it. I know that the 22nd Regiment, French-speaking regiment of the Canadian Army, they spoke French, I think, almost all the time, as far as I could see. I saw them on one or two occasions, and I flew one or two of their officers. They, of course, the officers were completely bilingual. But I think that the feeling we had, or so the British soldier had, was that the Canadians, the French Canadians, rather lived on a short fuse, that if they got a pounding for something, they went in and they really sorted the enemy out. And I'm afraid that most of the casualties in the Canadian Brigade seemed to crop up in the Vandoos. But they were a very good regiment. In fact, all their regiments were very good. But it was fairly significant that the French Canadians reacted very much more sharply and very much quicker than perhaps the others. They were, as I say, rather on a short fuse, I think.
You said that when you arrived in Korea, or when you're on your way to Korea, the mood of your men was one of adventure. What state of mind were they in at the time that you left?
Yes, I think that, as is typical in any war, that after a time, soldiers settle down, and the same applied to the airmen too, settle down into a routine almost, and became old sweats. This is rather the way they like to regard themselves. They knew the system, they knew sort of what to expect, and it was always interesting to see perhaps reinforcements or new chaps coming out and joining the flight. I didn't have many reinforcements during that time, but as they became time expired, new chaps were brought out. Always interesting to see the old sweats giving the new chaps a briefing on what to expect. Oh, don't worry about this, or don't worry about that. They'd learned all the shortcuts. They'd learned how to make themselves comfortable. They knew how to defend themselves. The sound of artillery fire and mortar fire didn't really worry them. And they would have, I think, given a good account of themselves if they had to face an enemy. But by the time they left, yes, they considered themselves as old sweats, but I think the biggest thing, the best thing for them that most of them went home with was an understanding of why they'd been out there. I hope by the time they went back they understood it, and really what the war was about. But for most of them, quite a lot of my chaps when they went back, I was pleased they went back all in one piece, and I got quite a few letters from these national servicemen written to me saying it was not an experience I would have volunteered for, but I was so glad that I went through it. I felt that I've had my soldiering experience. I feel that I've matured now and sort of have a better understanding of world affairs. Perhaps I don't understand everything, but more or less on those sort of lines anyway. Perhaps I don't understand everything, but at least I understand why we have to have armed services, why we have to have why these sort of wars crop up. I think in many of those cases they went back to good jobs. I still come across one or two of them, funnily enough. Even in London, I ran into a chap the other day who's now 30 years older, obviously, but coming up for retirement. But they went back, having gone out there as boys, went back as men.